Healy, superstar. Do you think you're what they say you are? Ricky Lee, superstar. Do you think you're what they say you are?
It's showtime with Ricky Lee. Thank you for joining me here on 101.5 Huntley Community Radio, with streaming and podcasts available at huntleyradio.com. Today is a very special program for me. Ever since seeing him on Broadway in Rent, I have idolized Adam Pascal. He originated the roles of Roger in Rent, Radames in Aida, and Chad in Disaster. He also appeared on Broadway in Cabaret, Chicago, Memphis, Something Rotten, and Pretty Woman. Welcome to the show, Adam.
Thank you, Ricky. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you so much for that lovely introduction.
Now, you made your Broadway debut in the musical Rent, and you had no acting experience, yet you earned a Tony nomination for Best Actor. Can you walk us through how that opportunity came to happen?
Sure. So I grew up in New York City and on Long Island, and I grew up playing in rock bands. And I had never done theater before. It never occurred to me to pursue theater. But I had been playing with a particular band for many years. And in 1995, I was living in New York City, and the band finally broke up after many years of no success. And I got a call from a childhood friend of mine named Idina Menzel, who grew up down the street from me. And she had already been cast in Rent. And they were still casting for the off-Broadway production. And she was aware of the fact that they were having trouble casting this particular role, this role of Roger. And she knew that they had opened up the casting to anybody who wanted to come in and audition. It wasn't just, you know, for established, theater actors. And so she thought of me, and she called me up and said, and explained to me what the situation was, and said that she had thought of me and asked if it would be something that I would be interested in. And, you know, I was at a place in my life where something new and interesting seemed new and interesting. And,
right.
And so the audition just consisted of me going in and playing a song with my guitar. And I just, you know, it was literally just like a lark. I wanted to see what the experience of going in and auditioning for something like this would be like. And that was how I got brought in for my first audition, you know, and then, excuse me. So I went in, I auditioned that first day. I sang a U2 song, and then they gave me a demo version of One Song Glory to go home and learn, and then come back and sing it. I came back the next day and I sang that. And then they had me come back again on Thursday and to sing One Song Glory again for some more people. And then they gave me a copy of Your Eyes to go home and learn, and then come back and sing that. So I ended up auditioning every day of that week. And then by Friday, I had the part.
That's incredible. What a wonderful experience. Now, when you left Rent, you kind of took a gamble and you went with something completely different, playing the MC in Cabaret. Was that?
Hold on, let me stop you.
Oh, okay.
Because Aida was in between.
Really? Oh, I thought the Cabaret was next. Okay.
Aida was next. So it was. I was out of, you know, it was interesting because after Rent, you know, like I said, I grew up playing in bands. And so after Rent, I thought, okay, well, now I'll finally get a record deal. You
know? Right, right.
And so doing another musical wasn't my first priority. But the record deal never came. And the audition for Aida did come.
Okay.
So that's where I ended up going. I'm very thankful that I did.
Now let's talk about Aida a little bit. That has the lyrics by my all-time favorite lyricist, Tim Rice, and the composed by Elton John. Did you have an opportunity, because you joined this in the pre-out-of-town trials, did you have an opportunity
there was an out-of-town trial that they had done for Aida a couple of years prior to me joining it.
Okay.
And in that production, it was a different director. It was a different production team. The only people left from that production were Sherry Renee Scott and Heather Headley.
Okay.
So they were the only carryovers. So I joined this next incarnation with Bob Falls directing and this whole new team of people involved in the production. So that's when I joined the process. But we did do an out-of-town tryout. We went to Chicago first, and then we came to Broadway.
And was the music evolving during the out-of-town tryout?
Yeah, you know, it always is. I mean, that's usually that's kind of the point in many cases of doing an out-of-town trout is to do lots of rewrites, mm-hmm. do lots of, you know, musical rewrites, do lots of, you know, text and book and lyric rewrites. And so a lot of that was going on, yeah, during that process. You know, songs taken from one character, lyrics rewritten and then given to another character, you know, things like that. It's a lot of tweaking. You know, the theory behind doing an out-of-town tryout, which isn't really applicable these days,
right.
but the theory was, you know, to go away from the spotlight of the Broadway community and to be able to work out your kinks, you know, in sort of, you know, quote unquote private.
Right.
But that's not really the case anymore. Obviously, you know, you might as well just go right to Broadway because, you know, everyone's watching you anyway. But everyone, for the most part, still does an out-of-town tryout because it still is an opportunity to work out those kinks. You're not doing it in the isolation that, you know, traditionally you would have done many years ago, but you are doing it at least not on the Broadway stage, and you get to hopefully tweak it as best you can before you get there.
And how was the AIDA experience different than Rent?
Well, I mean, just from a sort of a broad perspective, you know, Rent was this small off-Broadway, you know, no budget sort of ragtag type of, you know, situation of complete unknowns, you know, that had gone on obviously to become the huge success that it did. Then came AIDA, which was creating a musical from the opposite end of that spectrum. You know, Disney, all the money in the world, you know, Elton John, Tim Rice, lots of attention, lots of, you know, spotlight on us, lots of, you know, interest in us. And so it was actually a very interesting contrast to create two musicals back to back that literally, as I said, came from opposite ends of, mm-hmm. of that particular spectrum.
Great. Now let's jump to Cabaret.
And yes.
Was the idea to just do something totally different? Because that is pretty far from what you've done before.
It is. And yes, but, you know, more than that, I was just enamored by that show and that production and I wanted to be involved. And I had no idea if I could pull off a role like that. I mean, you know, that was a real actor's role mm-hmm. in a way that Radames and Roger weren't, at least from my perspective. Those two characters were in many ways similar to me, and certainly musically were right in my wheelhouse, you know. So Cabaret was this terrifying stretch of anything and everything I thought I might be capable of doing. And so I pursued that role basically for the entire production. And it wasn't until the very end did they offer it to me to be the final MC and to close the production. So, I never thought that I would even have the opportunity to do it because they kept saying, no, I'm not interested. but then for whatever reason, they had a change of heart and they asked me they extended the show and they asked me to join and close the production.
That's great.
And I'm glad I did because it really, it altered my career path because even after AIDA, I wasn't sold on doing theater and being an actor as my main career path. I was still holding on to that rock band thing. I was still holding on to that, you know, that music thing. And but having that opportunity to do Cabaret really solidified the career path for me. I developed a newfound love and respect for the craft in a way that I hadn't had before. And I developed a love for the hard work and the process that goes into learning a role like that. You know, I had 2 weeks to learn it, you know, and I think I rehearsed 18 hours a day, you know, to get it right. And then it was the most incredible experience, certainly up until that point, that I had ever had.
Well, now let's talk about that. You've been a replacement in a couple shows and, what is the rehearsal period like for coming in as a replacement? Are you working with the understudies?
Yeah. You generally work with the understudies and the dance captains and the assistant directors. That's always been my experience. And you have 2 weeks, you know, regardless of how big or how small the role is, you know, Huey Calhoun, you know, Billy Flynn, whatever it is, you know, it's like you get 2 weeks and that's it. And so having had that experience of Cabaret, as my first experience of being a replacement, I learned how much work it entailed. And so from that point on, whenever I took over a role, I was prepared. I knew that this was going to be a 15, 18 hour a day type of situation. And you know, maybe some people could do it different ways. You know, everyone has their own process of how they learn the role, how they learn the material, how they absorb it, all that kind of stuff. You know, and I learned what my process is and what I need to do to learn a role, to learn a lead role as, you know, as quickly and efficiently as I can.
And what is that process like for you?
Well, so one of the things that I do is I watch the show almost every night, you know, and what I do is I'll do a recording of the entire show, like an audio recording of the entire show. And then I will go back and I will edit out my part. So then I have an audio recording of the actual show with the actual actors responding to the dialogue. But my part is then edited out.
Wow.
So I can then actually. So, and then I'll learn the blocking, right? And then I'll go home and in my living room, I've got the blocking. I can envision the stage in my mind and I've got the other actors responding to the dialogue, you know, and giving me my dialogue cues as if it was in the actual performance. So I start to rehearse the show that way. So I actually get to, you know, pseudo interact with the actual actors in real time. And I discovered that early on, and that process has always worked, you know, incredibly well for me.
I think I'm going to steal that. That's great. Did you come up with that yourself, or was that an acting coach? Or
no, I did. I came up with that. You know, it just seemed like something that might work, and it seemed logical, and it's always worked really well for me.
What would you say was the biggest lesson you learned during cabaret?
It was about that. It was about the effort, you know, it really was. It was about the effort and to not rest on any kind of laurels. You know, everything that I did in cabaret were skills that I didn't have. You know, every number was a fully choreographed number. I had never done choreography before, you know, except for the La Vie Boheme choreography,
right.
You know. So I'd never done like real choreography before. Every number was fully choreographed. Full, you know, the full body makeup, full cost, you know, costumes in a way that I had never worn before. and the style of music was a style of music that I had never sung before. So I had to figure out, and I have since continued to do that, to adapt my voice. You know, people think of me as like the rock Broadway guy, but you know, I've worked really hard to expand my vocal dynamic and my vocal range to be able to do shows like that and to be able to do, you know, more traditional shows like that in like cabaret and I mean and like Chicago and I just did the Music Man out here, you know, like, so to do much more traditional type scores has always been, since that time, has always been really appealing to me because, you know, I've been singing rock style my whole life. And, you know, it would get pretty boring if that's the only thing I ever did. And so it's, you know, I find it really exciting and appealing to you know, have the opportunity to work on these much more traditional sounding styles of scores and traditional sounding styles of singing.
How often do you practice your voice every day? How often do you rehearse?
I don't practice. I don't rehearse, but I do sing every day.
Okay.
You know, I'm always working on something, for the most part. You know, so I generally do some kind of singing every day. But it's not practice, it's not rehearsal, because, you know, after all of these years, you know, and also I'm not a trained singer and I'm not a trained actor, so I don't have, you know, sort of a practice or rehearsal regimen that I do. I do have vocal warm-ups that I learned many years ago from our musical director on Rent. So I do have some vocal warm-ups, just some scales and things like that I do to warm up my voice before I'll do a performance. But I like to practice on the material that I'm working on. You know what I mean? To me, that's the most efficient and beneficial way for me to practice.
Now, you went from being a Broadway novice to being one of Broadway's most dependable and entertaining stars. now you share what you've learned as an actor by offering masterclass lessons through Artists and Beyond, which can be found at artistsandbeyond.com. What do you cover in your classes?
Well, I basically, the classes are acting through song. You know, as I said, I'm not a trained singer, so I don't give vocal lessons. I don't teach people how to sing. That's not my thing. That's not what I do. I work on the acting through song. And so they are predominantly acting classes. And I basically try and impart to people just the things that I have learned over the years through working and through being on the stage, you know, and through from absorbing from other people who have always been much better at it than I was, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that that's how I've always improved over the years with every show that I've ever done, is that I've been lucky enough to have been surrounded by these incredibly talented people who knew more than I did. And I was very much, you know, sponge-like in the sense that I just wanted to absorb anything that they had to offer, you know, directly or indirectly. And that's what I try and offer kids, you know? And so we take the perspective of auditions, mm-hmm. you know? And so we work on it from sort of working on like a 32 bar cut usually. And we'll just work on, a lot of it is quite frankly, relaxation techniques.
Mm-hmm.
And I wouldn't even call them techniques, just working on relaxation concepts to try and quell people's nerves. And also to make people understand the concept of less being more, which is a really difficult thing for novice actors to be able to internalize.
Mm-hmm.
You know, inexperienced actors have a tendency to think that they always need to quote unquote do something, you know? And so it's, I feel like it's my job to tell them to stop doing something
right.
and to start doing nothing. And to understand that being natural and organic is acting, you know what I mean? And you know, being mannered and thinking that they need to display some sort of physical something to convey an idea is generally not the way to go. It all happens in the eyes, and it happens in the face, and it happens in the voice, you know.
Now, these classes, which are available through artistsandbeyond.com, are either 30 minutes for $99 or 45 minutes for $149. It sounds like you cover a lot of great things in the classes. Is there one piece of advice that you always give every class?
Yeah, I mean, basically what I just said was is the sort of less is more concept. Mm-hmm. That's something that I always cover with people. And I use different examples of that, you know, and one of the examples I tend to use a lot is, you know, a lot of times when I know you can't see me, but I use a visual for this, but a lot of times, you know, when I'm working with people in person, a large group of people, one of the ways that I'll explain to them this idea is I'll say, okay, you guys are all sitting there. I'm on a stage. I'm talking to you. You're sitting in the audience and you are sitting there as yourselves, just listening to me talk, you know, like just take note of your body position, take note of your comfortability factor in your own body, just sitting there listening to me watch. Now I want you to stand up, and when you sit back down, we're going to be doing the exact same thing. But when you sit back down, I want you as actors to sit back down and listen to me talk to you. And inevitably, a number of people will sit back down and they will manner themselves in a way that they think makes them look like they're sitting there and listening to me. And I'll say, there you go. See what you're doing? You weren't just doing that before I told you you were an actor. I said, stop doing that. You know what I mean? I want you to do what you were doing before, you know? And so that tends to connect with them, you know?
Now, I recently saw the video of Memphis with the original Broadway cast, and you played Huey Calhoun. And so I tried to picture you as I was watching the movie. And Chad Kimball created such an oddball character. Did you try and keep that oddball factor when you took over the role?
No, I didn't. You know, it's not in my nature to imitate another actor's performance. Mm-hmm. You know, and not that I'm above stealing, mind you, but it's just not in my nature to do that. It just wouldn't feel natural. It just wouldn't feel comfortable. And as you said, he did something in that particular role that was so specific And I could never recreate that. You know what I mean? I wanted to create my own sort of organic version of the character, and that's how I approached it. And I actually ended up, you know, I actually got a good amount of time seeing other people, his understudy and a couple of his understudies perform the role, and that was really great for me because I got to see how another actor was able to do that role, and that helped me a lot. And then you know, one of the things also I learned from cabaret was, you know, I respond very well to makeup and to costume and to voice, you know what I mean? And to a physicality that I can find for the character. And that always worked really well for me. And so, you know, once I found the voice, the character started to, you know, realize itself, you know, within me. Once I got the dialect and you know, the voice down.
Mm-hmm. Now, in addition to your success on Broadway and in film, you've put out a number of albums, including the solo albums Model Prisoner and Civilian, as well as two releases with, is it Larry Edoff?
Edoff. Yes, Edoff.
Those releases being Blinding Light and The New Standards. How would you describe the music that you write?
Well, you know, I grew up a rock fan, you know what I mean? And so it's always been rock music inspired. You know, sort of, but as I've gotten older, I've gotten away from more guitar driven, riff driven type songs and much more singer songwritery kind of stuff. So, you know, I think the music has just evolved with me as I've gotten older. I think I've softened to a certain extent. I've tried to approach my lyric writing from a much more sensitive place, you know.
Yeah.
I think I used to write a lot of lyrics that in hindsight didn't make a lot of sense even to me. And so I've tried to approach it from a more personable and understandable place.
Now, would you ever consider writing a musical?
Yes, I actually have been working on an adaptation of a movie that I've been working on and off for many years. It's something that I just got inspired to do many years ago. I'm still, like I said, on and off working on it. I know what writing a musical entails, and I know how difficult it is. So I get inspired and then I get uninspired very easily. So I don't know if it will ever actually see the light of day, but it's definitely something that has been part of my creative process on and off for many years.
And I would imagine you also write music outside of for that musical, but just music for your albums and for personal growth. Do you tend to work on music every week writing songs?
I actually don't. And, you know, quite frankly, it's been a long time since I've worked on original music. You know, when the record industry, the industry has evolved and has changed so much from when I was a kid, and the financial viability of writing music doesn't really exist anymore in the way that it used to.
Yeah.
And not that that's the only reason to do it, but also, you know, look, I'm 50 years old. You know, my days of potentially being a rock star are over. And quite frankly, I'm not interested in that anymore. And you know, it's the kind of thing that, like, you know, you've got to keep flexing those muscles. And I kind of got out of practice. And so I've recently written some stuff and I've realized, you know what, this is not as good as the stuff I used to write because I'm just sort of out of practice. And you kind of do have to do it every day to be good at it and to continue to get better at it. You know, you can't just pick it up, you know, every 6 months and think you're going to write a great song. It doesn't work that way. So I tend to these days focus my creative efforts elsewhere in becoming a better musician. If I'm going to sit down and play music, I prefer to sit down and play music as opposed to write music.
Okay.
You know, that's more beneficial to what I do now and to what my career is now, to be a better guitar player, to be a better bass player, to be, you know what I mean? To be a better musician is much more interesting and exciting to me than to be a better songwriter.
Well, I'm going to end the interview with one last question. If you could go back in time and give one piece of advice to your younger self, what would it be?
To eliminate your ego as much as you can, and don't make decisions in your life based on ego ever, 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 ever. You will always regret it. And I tell students that all the time. You know, no matter what you achieve, no matter what happens in your life, if you allow your ego to make decisions for you, you will regret it. And I have. And so I have learned that firsthand.
And was that a part of the maturing process, coming to terms with, yes, I've had some problems in the past with my ego. Let's calm this down and get to work on it.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Again, you know, we don't learn and grow from success. We learn and grow from failure. And that has certainly been the case for me, you know, many times over. And failure takes many forms. Failure can be one thing for one person and can be something else for some, you know, the same event could be something else for somebody else, you know? And so it's all relative to the individual. So my failures may be somebody else's successes and vice versa, you know, it really depends. And will continue to learn and grow from those types of situations.
You've been listening to It's Showtime with Ricky Lee on 101.5 Huntley Community Radio. Today, my guest has been Broadway icon Adam Pascal. You now have the opportunity to have a one-on-one masterclass with Adam. For more information on that, go to artistandbeyond.com. You'll also want to check out Adam's albums, Model Prisoner, Civilian, Blinding Light, and The New Standards. Adam, it's been a joy having you on the show. Thank you for sharing your time with me and my listeners, and we wish you the very best.
Thank you, Ricky. It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
All right, buddy.